for the union labels. When you are buying Lacoste dress or blouse, remember somewhere our union's sewing.
Our wages going to feed the kids and run the house. We work hard, but who's complaining? Thanks to the ILG, we're paying our way. This rousing anthem, known as the Union Label Song, is a rallying cry for the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, asking consumers to check their clothing for that union label before laying down any cash. The local 114 put up quite a fight here in Kansas City back in the 1930s. That's when the garment industry was in full swing, doing a brisk business, both in manufacturing and in retail, and employing a lot of Kansas City women, immigrant women in particular. We'll get back to that story, but let's start at the very beginning. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is Central Standard, and today's show is about the history of Kansas City's garment industry. Monroe Dodd, resident historian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and good morning.
And Harvey Freed is here, too. His family worked in the garment industry, and he's involved in the Historic Garment District Museum of Kansas City. Hello, Harvey.
Good morning.
Last but not least, we're joined by Michelle Buchholz, who wrote a book about Hartsfield's, a Kansas City department store that changed the playing field for consumers and for the industry. Hi, Michelle.
Good morning.
So we have a great crew, and we're just going to get started. Monroe Dodd, how far back does Kansas City's garment industry go? Could you say it goes back to people trading fur pelts in the pioneer days, or is that not what we'd think of as industry just yet?
Well, they weren't making the hats that became that the felts went into, but they were trading with Native American tribes from farther west for the pelts of beavers, which made a could be made into a particular kind of hat that was fashionable in Europe in the 1820s and 1830s. But like all fashions, and as would still happens today, when the fashions pass, the industry can suffer or undergo great change. So yeah, it's a bit of a stretch. They weren't producing the garments, but they were making the stuff, getting the stuff for it.
Do you think that the beaver pelt hat could make a comeback?
I'm not going to wear one, even though I'm a little lacking for hair in the winters.
How and when did what we think of as the garment industry really start to take off in Kansas City?
After the turn of the century, it was propelled to some degree by the government opening a port of entry in Galveston, Texas. And so suddenly people were no longer all landing from Europe, specifically Eastern Europe, and specifically people with tailoring skills among them. They were
So what is the period before Galveston, Texas that you're alluding to when people were arriving?
In Philadelphia, in Boston, in places on the East Coast. And so you enter the country and you may not want to go far. But from Galveston, a route up to one of the major American cities, as always, Kansas City's central location played a role in the garment industry and attracting people like that.
And you're saying that there was a period where Eastern European immigrants with tailoring skills were arriving and being a major part, playing a major role in this industry. Tell me more about that.
Beginning things. They had a skill that they could put to use and subsist on and live on. And so they began garment shops, which grew into the garment industry. That's not only them, but also a woman from Kansas named Nell Donnelly, who with her husband came up here and started her own house dressmaking company in the 1920s and 1930s. A lot of what was made in Kansas City was utilitarian, sort of sometimes working class, sometimes uniforms. The uniform of the homemaker of the time in a different era for women was the house dress. Nell Donnelly put some various things on the house dress, ruffles and flourishes and whatever, and it became popular, and she sold lots of them, made a lot of money.
What would you say was the heyday of Kansas City's garment industry?
Well, different times. I think the 50s, probably where the post-war era, was the heyday for a lot of things in Kansas City. The garment district wasn't alone. TWA was booming. People had jobs. People were growing families. The suburbs were growing. And so with a lot of things, probably the garment industry prospered most then.
Were there major players other than Nell Donnelly who we should be talking about?
There were up to 75 companies, as I understand it, in the garment industry in Kansas City, around that number, and thousands of people working there. And some stood out. Fashion Built was one. Harvey will certainly know a lot of the names that I don't know. There was the Lee Company, which made dungarees and jeans for things, and for people who are working in agriculture, of which we're sitting in the middle of agricultural country.
Well, we're going to move on to Harvey's expertise in just a second, but before we do, there was a district in downtown known at the time as the Garment District. Describe where it was and what life was like there at the time, because now the only clue about it really is a street name, Petticoat Lane.
Yes, and museums and this conversation today. It lay pretty much south of 6th Street, which has been obliterated for the northern part of the I-70 loop, and north of 11th from Washington, generally over to Wyandotte, centering pretty much on Broadway.
So, Harvey, is this a different Kansas City than the one we know today?
Back then, it was different in the sense that everything was concentrated in the downtown area. There were no suburbs to speak of, and so everything focused in the downtown area.
And with the garment industry itself, your family's business was a part of that. Tell me your family's business story.
Well, in 1930, my dad started a wholesale dress company selling to retail stores in the Coates House at 10th and Broadway. And that later morphed into another company, and he went into garment manufacturing with some partners in 1939. Started manufacturing wool coats for juniors, and that continued up until we got out of that 1957, and then we shifted gears like you had to do all the time in the garment business. As fashions changed, and we started to lose our customers, too. And that started to make a big impact on the industry.
Why were you losing your customers?
Kansas City market concentrated on sales between the Appalachian and the Rocky Mountains, and we covered the territory pretty intensively. We all had salesmen out traveling the road, calling on stores in small, medium-sized communities. Well, as agriculture changed dramatically from little farms with lots of laboring people to bigger farms, specialized crops, fewer people, the small towns began to dry up. And some of the small towns, I still remember the first trip the sales manager sent me out onto a town called Eagleville, Missouri, just south of the Iowa line. And I thought he was pulling my leg as I turned off the highway. He said, Eagleville, population 70. But in that town, there were three stores that carried ladies' fashion apparel, serving a larger rural area, agricultural area. Well, if you go to Eagleville, Missouri today, which I happened to do off the highway about 10 or 12 years ago just to see what it looked like, there are no stores left. There's the square isn't even there anymore. So that's what happened throughout the Midwest, where our market served principally.
Well, what was your role in your family's business other than perhaps being one of the juniors wearing a wool coat?
No, I would junior women, and
okay.
we always try to, prepare people. Say, junior is a size, not an age. So, and there was fashion wise, it wasn't much different than regular ladies size garments. And our factory, we dealt only with woolen fabrics, so it was something that that was kind of unique in a sense. But that was true of all the industry here in town, the coat manufacturing industry. And manufacturing for ladies' coats, fashion coats, did start in the early 20s. Nellie Don, as it was referred to earlier, was kicked off about 1920. She was the first one to start to make what we called fashion apparel by jazzing up the cotton wash dresses that she started to make. Actually, she made aprons first. In our museum, we have a sample of her original apron.
When you were a kid, did you participate in your family's business in any way?
I used to love that. Come down on in the summertime and hang around the shipping department, and the shipping clerks taught me to be a shipping clerk and a receiving clerk, and I thought that was pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. I'll agree with you there. Harvey, how do you think that Kansas City shaped the garment industry and vice versa? I mean, how did the garment industry shape Kansas City?
Well, number one, at our peak, we were the second largest employer in the greater Kansas City area, preceded only by the stockyards and the packing houses. And we did give employment to lots of foreign-born people, immigrants, particularly women, whose English language skills weren't the best and probably precluded their having jobs and white-collar jobs in offices. So we did provide lots of employment for those people. And principally, the women who worked in our factory did the sewing, and So we did employ lots of women who otherwise might not have had opportunity to employ.
Monroe Dodd, I want to find out from you. I mean, first of all, tell me about the waves of immigration that Harvey was alluding to. Who was arriving in Kansas City and working in this garment industry?
Around the turn of the century, about the same time this this thing was just getting up and going, there were waves of immigrants from Italy, specifically Sicily, Italian immigrants. There were Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe and places that were fleeing for various reasons. Certainly Kansas City had black immigrants from the South and Hispanic immigrants. Kansas City has always had at least some Hispanic community, which is, of course, growing today. All these people were new to all this. And as Harvey mentioned, when you have a language challenge and maybe you even have a color challenge and you look different from the dominant society, that can sometimes shut you out of some jobs. There were also immigrants from the Slavs and Croats and others who worked in the packing houses down in the West Bottoms. It was Kansas City boomed itself as an all-American city at the time. And I think that was a Chamber of Commerce notion trying to say to the world, you're safe to have your factory here. We don't have a lot of foreigners with crazy ideas moving in. But in fact, Kansas City did have some foreigners, and it did prosper from as a result of that, as diversity almost always does. When outsiders come in, they bring new ideas and new things, and I think Kansas City was helped by that, no matter how it boasted.
What do we know about how all of these different groups of workers got along working together in these factories, maybe even with language barriers for communicating with one another and their bosses?
Well, they got along generally pretty well. Of course, there was still racism, and there was the distinction between who had what kind of jobs. And management, we didn't get too much involved with that because the union pretty much dictated how we should perform. Interesting, in our museum, there's a picture of one of the earliest coat manufacturing companies, a picnic that they took, and there's a large picture of all their employees, all the white employees, and there's a separate picture next to it for all the black employees. So there were some bit of problem, but not too much, because we had people who spoke different languages. As was said earlier, they came from all over Europe, and particularly a lot of Italian women worked in the factory. I got to go to a lot of Italian weddings, which was kind of fun too. I got invited to those. But people got along pretty well, and even though there was a lot of competition among the different manufacturers, we all cooperated, and we had several organizations that met on a regular basis, which consisted of the officers of the various companies. We had a Kansas City Apparel Association. We had a Kansas City Garment Manufacturers Association. So both those catered to the industry in Kansas City.
Michelle Buchholz, you wrote a book on Hartsfeld, and that is a department store. There's the manufacturing side of the garment industry, which we've been hearing about, and then there's retail. The two obviously interact, and before we launch into the Hartsfeld story, I'd like you to tell me a little bit about the relationship between the two in Kansas City.
Well, Hartsfeld's was one of several specialty and department stores here in Kansas City that followed the same trajectory that Monroe was just saying about the history of Kansas City and when the boom moments were, where it was high and where it was a little bit dipping maybe.
So remind me of those boom moments.
Well, Hartsfeld's opened in 1891, and they were also enjoying the traffic from the fur trade and had quite a few offerings related to furs, where you could have anything made for you custom at that moment. Also kind of relating to the ready-to-wear movement that
What's
was starting
that?
To happen. In the days before ready-to-wear, you needed to be your own seamstress, or you needed to hire a seamstress to create fashions for you to wear. That's where your clothing came from. And so with Hartsfeld's opening in 1891, they brought this notion to Kansas City. Sigmund Hartsfeld came from Chicago. He was financially backed by the Siegel family in Chicago and brought that to Kansas City, which was fantastic. I would say the history of retail in Kansas City, the downtown, as has been suggested, was really where it was at. In many ways, the Petticoat Lane became kind of the fashion center for Kansas City and the Midwest. And as far as how that connects with the Garment District, I was trying to find some of those connections, some of the labels that were carried by Harsfelds were homegrown right here in Kansas City, Gay Gibson and Nellie Don. And I know that when we were trying to do our research for the book, we were trying to understand what that connection was then when we were trying to put it down through our research. And the Kansas City Star has a lot of advertising, historical advertising documents that were useful to us. And we realized that Nellie Don was actually celebrated all week long by Nellie Don Week. So at some point it was embraced by the buyers at Harsfelds to acknowledge kind of the fashion that was evolving over time within the Kansas City district. And offering that to local folks here.
So for the totally uninitiated, what is Harsfelds?
Well, Harsfelds was a specialty store that focused on women's clothing. Originally, it opened in 1891, actually as the Parisian Cloak Company. It became Harsfelds later on in 1913. It was opened down on Main Street, and it opened to non-paved streets at that time. Obviously, they were dust.
So the Parisian Cloak Company on a dust road.
Yes.
And I love it.
Yes. And so some people say that Petticoat Lane may have come from the dust from the petticoats of people leaving their carriages to shop on the strip down there. But likely that probably came from a more historical notion over in England.
You are a graphic designer at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. What made you want to write a book about Harsfelds?
Well, this project found my husband and I. My husband Joe and I are both graphic designers, so we have an appreciation for ephemera and photography and illustration and art and architecture. And we were at a flea market a number of years ago where we came across material from Erasmus Bell. He was the display director for some 30 plus years at Harsfelds. And we were kind of making a pile of things that looked interesting to us, and the pile became larger and larger. And we decided that it started to tell a story, and we wanted to learn a little bit more. So we started diving in and researching a little bit.
What was it that you saw that made you realize you were looking at a story? I mean, take me to that moment with you.
Well, Joe and I were putting aside our printed material that we were sifting through, $2 an item. And there were some original photographs of people that looked like they were wearing some wonderful clothes, high fashion. There were some original fashion illustrations. There were some suggestions of scripts from some plays that were put on, these very highly scripted fashion shows. It just sounded very interesting and looked very interesting.
What did Harsfelds change when it came not just to fashion, but really daily life and consumer habits in Kansas City?
Well, I think the convenience for women to not have to be strapped to that sewing machine, be able to feel a little more fashionable and up to date, as we are known here in Kansas City, highly influenced by European fashions. They had a French room where you could go. There would be couture labels there that you could try on for a very special occasion. I know that during our conversations with a variety of people over the years, people remember shopping there. They remember the service fondly. They remember the selection, the quality of the material, and the fashions being very special. Some people shop there more frequently. Some people went for a very special occasion. But very happy memories for a lot of people here in Kansas City. It was a very long history.
Harvey Fried, talk to me about the retail landscape more broadly. I mean, paint the picture of the shopper's world in Kansas City at this time.
Well, I just like to make one comment.
Please.
The relationship between the garment manufacturing industry and the retail stores in Kansas City was always kind of a up and down, a little bit of friction from time to time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, the Kansas City was known as a specialty store town, not a department store town, because other towns like Omaha and Des Moines had bigger department stores than we ever had, but we had a lot of specialty stores. And they looked to the New York market as their principal source of supply, which was the major market. So we had several meetings on occasion that I attended where we met with some of the downtown merchandise people to find out how we could do more business with downtown retail stores. And it didn't work out to change very much. We all did a little business with the downtown department stores and specialty stores, but never to our satisfaction. Except for like Nellie Don did, and I think Gay Gibson probably did a great job.
So a couple of big names were maybe prominent in those department stores,
right.
Whereas the rest of you, it sounds like, were taking your wares throughout the Midwest and maybe the South, and also into these maybe more specialty stores, as you were saying.
Right, and we traveled earlier and showed our lines earlier than the New York market did. And as a result, our outside salesmen looked for orders earlier than the downtown retail stores were willing to place orders. So we really depended on our out-of-town customers for our existence.
Monroe, how did the Great Depression affect industry in general in Kansas City, but especially the garment industry? We're talking about a time period that does include the Great Depression. I don't imagine this was a good time for exorbitant spending on fashion or anything else.
The Great Depression affected everybody across America, or well, nearly everybody, which would include the towns where there were these retailers who were ordering stuff, and I presume they was ordering fewer goods from the garment industry because they had fewer customers, and credit was limited during that time. Kansas City was helped some through the Great Depression by jobs created by the WPA and buildings and things that the Pendergast 10-year plan had put together. But essentially, but most people, I think, were finding that they're going to have to cut back. Apartment buildings stood unfinished in Kansas City. Building permits went down. And so all kinds of spending went down here and across the Midwest, and that had to have an effect on the garment manufacturers.
Harvey, what do you know about that?
Well, I grew up in that era, I wasn't quite aware of who was going in and out of business, but it always seemed like a booming, active, thriving industry as a kid. I mean, the streets were always crowded, particularly on Monday mornings when this merchants might come in from out of town. But there was a lot of hustle and bustle, particularly along Broadway. And I never sensed that. We knew things were kind of tough. And, you know, even remember as a kid, a dust storm blowing into Kansas City and spattering mud on our stucco house, but you know, those are the kind of thing. 1937, I think that was. But anyway, we managed to survive, and the industry managed to do pretty well. Although, as Monroe said, I think our peak period was immediately after post-World War II, and then it started to slow down to not very long after that.
And in fact, World War II probably helped your industry out by all the manufacturing for the military, didn't it?
There was some manufacturing military. Our problem as manufacturer of woolen products is we couldn't get woolens because they were going principally into wartime production.
So that does bring up, though, the idea that you mentioned that things started going downhill. I'd like everyone here to kind of weigh in on what you would think ultimately led to the garment industry of Kansas City's demise. I mean, it can't just be one thing, but what are some of the things? We'll start with you, Harvey.
Well, we sold, as I said earlier, principally to independent retail stores, and the small town stores went out of business, and the big city independent retail stores started to go out of business at being impacted by larger stores and box stores. And as I recall, when I first started working, we had between 38th and 40th on Main Street, there were 7 apparel specialty stores that carried ladies' fashion clothing. Now there are about that many check cashing places, but no retail stores.
Michelle?
I agree that the big box stores coming in does not allow for the specialty store at a little bit earlier time in the 80s when things finally closed. 1984 is when Hirschfeld's closed. And I also wanted to mention that not only was there the downtown store, but they had several satellite stores. So to your earlier question of how did Hirschfeld's connect in with the garment industry and what was happening in the greater world, it moved out to the suburbs. It went to Blue Ridge. It went to Corinth. The Plaza was a favorite location for people. Metcalf South. And I think that from a retail standpoint, Hirschfeld suffered a little bit once it moved into the public sector, went on to the public market. It was purchased and then purchased again and then purchased again by larger and larger conglomerates, and retail just gets bigger and bigger and fewer and fewer. And so it kind of went by the wayside.
Monroe, what are some of the big factors at work here when you think about the demise of Kansas City's garment industry?
In addition to combinations of stores into big box stores and things, you have to also look at technology. Technology on the farm that meant fewer workers had to be used to grow wheat and to raise cattle, and that means fewer clothes to be sold. Technology in advertising. Catalog stores were a big market for a lot of the garment industry, as I understand it. Catalog sales, and when catalog sales went down and national retailing took its place, that's going to affect it too.
I've got to jump in because that music means we're headed to a break. When we come back, we'll dig into some more of this discussion. We'll take a closer look at some of the labor disputes in Kansas City's garment industry, and we'll ask how the Kansas City we live in today might reflect pieces of this story you're hearing now. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is Central Standard on KCUR. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman on KCUR's Central Standard, and today we're learning about Kansas City's garment industry. For decades, an entire downtown district was dedicated to the making and selling of clothes. So what happened? Our guests are historian Monroe Dodd, author Michelle Buchholz, and Harvey Freed, whose family was part of the garment industry in its heyday. We'll get back to some of the causes for that industry's demise shortly, but we haven't talked much about labor and unions. That's a big part of the story, too. There's an exhibit right now at the National Archives of Kansas City called All Sewn Up, and it focuses on the legal battles of the garment industry. Now, some of those are about trademark and copyright infringement, a lot of them, in fact, and some of it has to do with labor issues. Harvey, what do you know about the legal battles of Kansas City's garment industry?
I'm not really familiar with that, or that we had very many. I know that the union, our industry became unionized in 1938, and we had contracts, I think they expired every 3 years, by product. And there were the coat manufacturers had a union contract, the dress sportswear guys had a contract too. We didn't really experience any particular labor problems. I don't recall there was ever a strike in all the time I was in around the industry at all.
Monroe, what was going on, but like broadly with labor issues in Kansas City in this time?
A sit-in strike at the Ford Motor plant. There were organizational questions. The Wagner Labor Act in the mid-1930s, part of the New Deal, had empowered labor in a lot of ways, and that's why a lot of labor organizing went on then. Labor leaders were optimistic. They looked forward to organizing things. Company employers, I think, sometimes feared that wages would go up and benefits would have to be paid more, and so there was a natural tension there. It expressed itself in Kansas City at the Donnelly Garment Company, the maker of the house dresses of Nellie Don. In 1937, the International Labor's Ladies Garment Workers Union, began to try to organize it. The Donnelly Company went to court to try to fight this. They lost the fight, but not until 1946. And the union finally organized the Nellie Don Company in the late 1960s. But there was a long struggle about this. And it was often the typical kind of labor union stuff, employees of a non-union company going in, being sometimes, in their way of looking at it, intimidated by union people trying to organize. Union people saw these people as hurting their efforts to organize and working for less than they ought to work. So there was a tension there that began because of labor's newfound strength as a result of the New Deal.
In this exhibit at the National Archives, there you see full-page ads that one side and the other sort of taking turns, purchased in the Kansas City Star to sort of I mean, there was a pretty public forum, one side versus the other in this fashion. Was that common? Was that a tactic that was, I mean, I can't imagine that today.
Actually, it still has been fairly common until about the 1990s when the newspaper industry began to slide. You would see full-page ads in the New York Times appealing to the court of public opinion for one cause or another. Friends of this country, friends of that country, all trying to get a popular feeling going because, as you know, a lot of responses of government and everything comes from, oh my gosh, the people, the voters, they want it this way. And so, yeah, the appeals went out for that, and I can easily see that happening in the 1930s in the newspapers.
I read an article about a union leader who was sent to Kansas City to organize garment workers. I guess the National Women's Trade Unions League sent someone kind of undercover to check out conditions in factories, and he came back for an earful with an earful for them, having to do with a really pretty wide variety of things, including some pay issues, enforcement of what was then Missouri's 9-hour work law for women, and this concept of homework, women taking home additional sewing work. So they sent this guy to organize strikes, and it seems like part of this story is that Kansas City manufacturers might have interpreted this guy as having been sent by their competitors to put them out of business. Is that something that you recall, Harvey, this period in the 1930s? You would have been very, very young to know about labor disputes, I should mention.
Well, actually, my dad didn't invest in a garment manufacturing company until 1939. So by that time, the labor problems had been pretty well resolved.
Yeah.
And so the wholesale business was never unionized. That was the wholesale, but not the manufacturing, but the wholesale business was not unionized.
So this all, it sounds like it did get pretty well resolved.
And I think you have to remember that a lot of the union stuff, as with so much stuff in the world, is in the eye of the beholder. The Donnelly Garment Company thought it had good wages and good benefits, and its people were very happy. It would throw Christmas programs every year, picnics, as Harvey mentioned and stuff. To the people who ran that company, they were doing a fine job by their employees, and look, they kept their employees. The union people, of course, saw a different side of things, and that's as true today as it was then.
So do talk to me, though, about gender in the garment industry.
Well, most of the workers who sat at the sewing machines, we called them, we didn't call them sewing machines, I forget how we used to refer to them, but they were much faster, much speedier than the home sewing machines. And our labor was principally women in doing the sewing and in the finishing also, and women had a lot to do with styling, design, and pattern making. And men played a comparatively small role outside of being involved in sales and in management. Mostly it was heavily a woman industry.
Harvey, what were the first signs you saw that the garment industry might have been on the decline?
Well, as I said earlier about the change in agriculture, but another thing that came a little later on was a change in fashion. If you look at the way people dress today and look what we manufacture in Kansas City, there's hardly any connection anymore.
I would love a wool coat, though.
All right. And we used to also make wool suits, and you hardly see any woman wearing wool suits anymore on the street. And so that contributed a great deal.
Michelle, department stores aren't what they used to be, but the independent shops like the ones Harvey's spoken about earlier, those do seem to be making a bit of a comeback. That's what it seems like to me. Is there a revival of an old mindset, or are today's shops a different animal?
I think what's old is new again, maybe. As fashions come back into vogue, we're seeing a nice resurgence in specialty shops, boutiques. I think Kansas City is ripe right now for enjoying a new moment, and it's kind of fun that we're having this conversation with so much happening now downtown, because early on that's where it was at, and then it kind of went out to the suburbs and went kind of quiet, and now it's coming back in. So I'm very excited to see a little bit of that resurgence happening right now. And to kind of piggyback on what Harvey was saying about the change in fashion, Harsfeld's, their bread and butter was based on hats and gloves and suits and all sorts of accessories, shoes for women and for children. And those accessories had fallen out of fashion and are now back in.
So, I mean, are there lessons we should be paying attention to today in this story of the rise and fall of the garment industry in particular, and maybe just a local industry more in a bigger sense? I'll start with you, Michelle, from the fashion standpoint.
Well, I think Kansas City maybe appreciates its history in this area, and hopefully they will continue to support in a very strong way these new endeavors that are happening that we see all around us right now, and bringing some things back to the core of Kansas City.
Monroe, what about you? I mean, lessons from a business standpoint or from a culture standpoint in Kansas City?
I think the lesson from the culture standpoint is, as Michelle kind of referred to earlier, if you wait 20 or 30 years, sometimes things will come back. It was much bemoaned in the early 1970s that there were only a couple of brewers left in the United States making very nondescript beers. And then, boom, the micro brewing industry comes back. I think the same is true in fashion. The same is true in artisan work, furniture, and lots of things.
Monroe Dodd, Michelle Buchholz, and Harvey Fried, thank you all so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gina.
Tonight at the National Archives, you can hear two more voices on this subject. The co-authors of a book called We Were Hanging On by a Thread will give a talk. Go to the National Archives website for more information. When Central Standard returns, it's all about the Demolition Derby. Stay tuned.